Word Balloon is brought to you by AlexRossArt.com. Alex has been a longtime sponsor of Word Balloon. I greatly appreciate it. You got to go to his website. You will find tremendous art, from original work, covers, pages, fantastic lithographs, amazing posters. Every price point is covered, and every subject is covered at AlexRossArt.com. You've enjoyed his iconic looks at DC and Marvel, but also great stuff like his wonderful work on The Monkees, Monty Python, so many other great pop culture things that Alex has put his fingerprints on. His wonderful Flash Gordon poster that evokes the fantastic Dino De Laurentiis Sam Jones movie. Recently, Alex did things like the timeless Marvel covers featuring great solo shots of all your favorite Marvel heroes, and of course his Fantastic Four full circle graphic novel, still available. All waiting for you now at AlexRossArt.com.
Barnaby Jones will return next Thursday night at 10, 9 Central and Mountain on most of these stations.
Word Balloon is brought to you by the League of Word Balloon Listeners. Coming February 21st, it's Faye and the Moon, the latest graphic novel from Franco and the Saturn Sisters. Faye, mourning for her missing mother, sits night after night below the moon that her mother loved dearly. One night she discovers she can pluck the moon out of the star-filled sky. Back safe in her house, she holds it close, feeling comfort at last. Then Faye loses the moon and finds that taking it has awakened ancient monsters, rats, dragons, and more, who hunt for it for themselves. Will Faye be able to reclaim the moon, find her own inner strength, and save the world from eternal darkness? Faye and the Moon comes from the minds of Franco, whose works include Tiny Titans, Superman of Smallville, Archimaniacs, Itty Bitty Hellboy, and The Ghost and the Owl, and art from the Saturn Sisters, whose animated works include Sesame Studios' The New Neighbors, Hulu's The Awesomes by Seth Meyers, and PBS's Mira, Selkie from the Sea. Pre-order Faye and the Moon now. Available in bookstores and comic shops everywhere, February 21st. Welcome back, everybody. It's time again for Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. Always happy this guy can make time in his busy schedule to spare a few minutes with us. It's Brad Meltzer. Welcome back, Brad.
I love hearing you, man. This is a treat, because unlike we usually wind up, I don't know if anyone even knows, but we usually wind up talking before the book comes out. True. And you're the first interview, and now on this one, just because of the way everything worked, you get to kind of close the entire tour down, which I appreciate.
Hey, it's my pleasure as always, buddy. You got two great books I'm very excited to talk about. I Am John Lewis. Wonderful to see the great civil rights leader and fantastic congressman given the I Am treatment, and give kids a chance to get into this incredible man. I don't know about you, Brad, but I got to see him at San Diego Comic-Con.
When he dressed up, when he cosplayed as himself?
Pretty much.
I'm serious. You saw what he did that.
No.
It's been there. Oh, I'm not joking. No. So you got to look it up. Put in John Lewis cosplay at Comic-Con. And famously on Bloody Sunday, when he walked and did the march from, to Selma, is the big march. He was wearing a beige trench coat. It looks like a trench coat and a backpack. And that's the famous photograph. You'll see it everywhere. If you put John Lewis marching to Selma, you'll see this famous photograph of him in this outfit. So when he goes to Comic-Con one year, and I'm going to give full credit to Andrew Aiden and Nate Powell, who are my brothers and, they're the reason this book came out the way it came out. They are the authors and artists of March, of the graphic novel that they wrote with him and did with John Lewis. Dear friends of Chris Eliopoulos and myself. But John Lewis shows up to Comic-Con and he's wearing the outfit from when he was like 20 years old, and he's cosplaying as himself.
It's incredible.
Friggin' amazing. It's because it's an iconic photograph. It's like, it's like Amelia Earhart showing up in the goggles or Abe Lincoln wearing the hat again, and you're just like, but you never see any living person, that's that famous go to Comic-Con as them. The whole thing was spectacular. So I think for that alone, you earn an I Am book, but it really was one of the great moments. And I also got to meet him here in Miami I'm not sure if people know, but he was one of the early proponents of the Ordinary People Change the World kids book series. So he told me during an interview that he really liked our I Am Rosa Parks book. And when we were doing I Am Martin Luther King Jr., I always try and find the expert in whoever we're working on. You know, like when we do Dolly Parton, we go to Dolly Parton. When you go to Jane Goodall, you go to Jane Goodall. But, you know, it's hard to go to Dr. King or George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. So you got to find that person who's like, who's the expert? And I was like, you know, I could ask John Lewis. He marched with him. He was there with him. He was there at the March on Washington with him.
Yeah.
And thanks to Andrew and to Nate, they connected us. And they, you know, John Lewis was, if you look in the back of I Am Martin Luther King Jr., he's the advisor on the book who we thank in the back. So the only, my only regret is I never got to tell him we were doing a book about him.
That's wonderful, man. No, when I saw him, it was, you know, he was dressed like Congressman Lewis, you know, he's walking around. And it was so great because I knew his backstory that he, you know, he appreciated comic books. And it's great that Aiden and Nate were able to get him to agree to do the graphic novel series as they did. But that was the great thing. It was really, he was warm and we all were just so thrilled to see him. But also at the same time, we gave him space because it's like, oh my God, this is, like you said, this is like Amelia Earhart suddenly being there. There were so few historic people. I mean, sure, you get Angelina Jolie or whoever hawking their new movie or TV show, but it's like, oh my God, it's John Lewis. This is incredible.
Oh no, but that's the thing is, and you know, any of us who love comics, the moment someone says, "Well, I've read comics my whole life," we're immediately judgmental, right? We're like, bullshit. We know you're trying to sell us something. And so years ago, I was working on a thriller. And I was with Patrick Leahy, Senator Patrick Leahy,
yes,
chief of staff. And he's like, he had me shadow him around for days. Like, why don't you come to the office and, you know, you'll shadow me around, because I was writing a book and I wanted to see what it was like in Congress. And where, you know, I'm shadowing for like, it's like half the day. And we finally get to the senator's office and I can see that and he's the senator from Vermont. So, it's, you know, being a senator is a big deal. It's not like Congress, you know, like being a representative. There's only, you know, there's only 100, you know, this is it. You get two from every state. There's 50 from, you know, 50 states. You get 100 people. That's it. So this is a big job, right? Big deal. And on the wall in his office is a picture of Batman. And my immediate thought, John, is this is some kind of BS that he put up to make people be like, oh, he likes Batman. And that's kind of be cool. And just to be clear, this isn't when comics were popular. This is about, you know, 20 years ago.
Sure.
And so this is not like in the heyday of where we are now, where, you know, everyone's wearing a Batman t-shirt from the Gap and Target. Like, and so seeing a Batman thing up, you were like, he's, you know, and he's, I said, oh, who likes comics here? And chief of staff says, oh, Senator Leahy does. And I'm like, no. And he sees my face. I'm like, no, he doesn't. So as I'm in the office, Senator Leahy calls the congressman. And I had just been announced to be the writer of Green Arrow. They had just announced it. So I'm in the office with the chief of staff. Senator Leahy calls up, and the chief of staff says to him, I'm here with Brad Meltzer. He's the thriller writer, but he's actually going to be writing Green Arrow. And he says, and all of a sudden I say, uh-huh, he says, and then he takes the phone and he hands the phone to me. He says, the senator would like to speak to you. So I go, I'm like, oh crap, what do I do now? Am I in trouble? You know, and like, he's like, and I pick up the phone. I say, hello, Senator. And Patrick Leahy says to me, you're doing Green Arrow, huh? And I go, yes, sir. And he says, with the arm or without the arm?
Awesome.
And I literally go, and I'm just dead silent. And obviously, of course, it's a Dark Knight reference, you know, from, you know, Frank Miller's masterpiece. And I'm so stunned that after 5 seconds of silence, Leahy says to me, you didn't think I knew what I was talking about, did you? And I'm like, I didn't. I was honest. I'm like, I didn't. I didn't think you knew it. I thought you were just like faking it. And he totally knows his stuff. And of course, everyone knows he's got lots of cameos in the Batman movies. But it's not because he just like thinks it's cool to be in Batman, which of course it is. But he is a serious reader. So if you look at the Archer's Quest, when we first did it, the introduction is written by Senator Patrick Leahy. So the point is when you find those people, when it's John Lewis, whether it's Patrick Leahy, like, you know, you find your people and you're like, these are people who like understand stuff, how we like stuff.
100%, man. And again, it only in these I Am books, in the case of John Lewis, it only makes them more relatable to their kid audience. But again, you always find these wonderful little factoids about these people and what makes them relatable to kids. And also the accomplishments. You forget sometimes the incredible things he did as a congressman and as an advocate to illustrate, you know, the black experience and the history of black people in America. It's amazing.
Yeah, you know, and for this one, one of the my favorite story in there is, you know, John Lewis, when he's a little kid, his parents always told him, like, you know, don't get in trouble. Like, just don't make a big, you know, scene, lay low, just lay low.
Yeah.
And his grandmother was built very differently. So when he's a little boy, the rule was if you were black and you were walking down the street and there was a white person walking at you on the same block, you were expected as a black person to cross the street and make way for that white person who was walking. And his grandmother just was not built that way. She just was. And so she would, everyone else would go out of the way, but she would always respectfully would just be like, you know, excuse me, pardon me. I'm just going to be walking here. Thank you very much. And John Lewis, as a little boy, saw that. And he saw the lessons of Rosa Parks and he saw the lessons of Dr. King. And, you know, those are the people who taught him to get into what he called good trouble, necessary trouble. When you see injustice, you got to use your voice. And of course, you know, many of us know the story. He, you know, he does make sure to always protest in a nonviolent way. He used to go to training and people would spit at him and curse at him and throw stuff at him and kick him and fight him and punch him. And the one question that John Lewis said he was asked more than any other question was, how do you keep your calm? How do you keep your calm when everyone's just doing these horrible things to you?
Yeah.
And his answer was his faith. But he defined faith as believing in something so deeply that you will make a way out of no way. And man, I love that idea, making a way out of no way. And so, you know, I love the fact when you, you know, to me, that's a lesson I want for my daughter. That's a lesson I want for my sons. Like, I think when you see that level of injustice, especially now, you got to use your voice, you got to speak up, and you got to get in good trouble. So that's obviously what I Am John Lewis as a book is all about, those kind of parts that we can relate. We don't get into like his politics or what he voted for now, but like,
no.
It's about those things, those lessons you want for your own kids and your nieces and your nephews.
Well, and protesting what's wrong and trying to make it right. And I love the section as well. And you do it very succinctly. You talk about Jim Lawson, the guy who taught the workshop on civil disobedience. And I think you point that out very well and very clearly.
No, listen, you know, it's not just you. And I'll be honest, like I thought, you know, of course, until we started doing the research years ago on Dr. King's book. But I just always thought, oh, you know, if you're going to do nonviolent resistance, just be cool. Everybody just don't fight back. I didn't realize there were full training sessions for it, that
yes.
You were going regularly to the church at night and they were going to literally pour coffee on you to see how you reacted and scream at you in your face to see how you react and, you know, and go through all this role playing. And, you know, there was so much commitment to make sure that, you know, nonviolence resistance isn't just like an idea. It's an entire philosophy that, you know, is followed and has rules and has, you know, ways you can apply it. And you better believe we showed that. And, you know, just as much as we showed the organizers of the March on Washington, we were like, you know, there's so many unsung heroes. Everyone wants to say, look, Dr. King, and here's a speech and racism was beaten. And we all, of course, know that, you know, it's never. It was, you know, I talked to Andrew and Nate about this. And the lesson also that John Lewis gave us when we did the Dr. King book, you don't give the speech and everything's better again. That's just the beginning of the fight. And I think, you know, you, especially now, especially where we are today, we have to give our kids and show them how to fight back.
Agreed. And I also think too, Lewis literally took his lumps on the line when he would protest. And there are those incredible photographs of him bloodied, when he would, practice civil disobedience and refuse to budge and just, you know, but do it in a nonviolent way. It's a timely book, Brad. And, you know, I mean, that's sad because I think you and I coming from this generation we came from, we thought and things are getting better and we're getting better. But also we got a very clear reminder in the last couple of years that we still have a lot of work to do and a lot of awareness still needs to be done.
Listen, when I finished our book on Abraham Lincoln, on the plot to kill Abraham Lincoln, I thought, man, the Civil War just never ended.
Yeah.
And then we do this book on Nazis. And I'm like, you know what else didn't end? World War II never ended. Like, we're still fighting Nazis. We're still fighting racism. I mean, And I wish I was smart enough, John, to be like, oh, you know, I did these books as a, you know, because I saw the injustice. And I didn't. I just found the stories I thought were interesting. But what's so sad is how relevant these stories are. We decided we were going to do this book 2 years ago. And just how relevant it is today. And it, you know, that's, it's just heartbreaking to me that we're still at this point where I know we take some obviously great strides forward, but it just feels like every day we're also stepping back. I mean, I'm watching these book bans that are happening. I'm watching, I live in Florida. I'm watching what they're doing to books and to people here in Florida. And, you know, sometimes you just feel like, I can't believe we're still fighting Nazis. I can't believe we're still fighting book bans in 2023.
Yeah, I hear you, man. No, I, and thank you too for sending me The Nazi Conspiracy, the new book, and the subtitle, The Secret Plot to Kill Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. These were the Allied leaders of World War II, very different men, very coming at World War II with a very different philosophy, all three of them. And this incredible story of, again, they were standing in the way of Nazi Germany. I mean, Norm Macdonald, the great comedian, used to do a joke, and it's sad but true, that, you know, Germany just kind of decided, hey, we're going to attack the world. And it's like, geez, you know, so we needed these men, all three of them, to step up and unite and find common ground to fight the Nazis. It's, and also just this incredible story of they had to go. I mean, they were standing in the way of total domination by Hitler and the Nazis.
Yeah, and you know what I think is, you know, we tell this story like we tell the stories in comic books. We've turned World War II into a good versus evil thing, you know? And it is one of those moments. It's one of those rare moments in history. The reason I think World War II is so popular is because it is one of those moments where, you know, the U.S. government comes in, we stand against the bad guys, we beat the bad guys, everyone agrees we all did the right thing. Like, when was the last time anyone said that about the American government, right? Yeah. Where every side agreed, whatever you were on, we did the right thing. And but what we do to tell that story is we turn it into this black and white story, right? We turn it into, you know, as if it was a foregone conclusion, the good guy's going to win. We punch the Nazis in the jaw and democracy is saved. And I think what was really eye-opening for me is to see that our victory was completely not a foregone conclusion. It seems so obvious now, but you can see at the start of it, you have, you know, when we, the Nazi conspiracy set up around 1943, it's the height of the war.
Yeah.
It's the moment where Stalin, who, you know, again, we look at Stalin and Churchill and Roosevelt and we all look at them, they stand together, the big three, isn't it great? And it's like, you know what? Stalin wasn't even on our side at the beginning of the war. He was on the Nazi side. It's only when the Nazis invade the Soviet Union that he's like, man, maybe I should go be on the Allies side. And he's suddenly now on our side. And so this, you know, alliance that's formed is completely untrustworthy. You've just had your main guy from the Soviet Union switch sides. And Stalin wants us to invade continental Europe. He's getting decimated by the Nazis. We're sending munitions, but he's like, you got to come out and help me. And it's FDR who, you know, is like, we got to get everyone together, look each other in the eye, decide on troop movements, decide on morale, decide on supplies, you know, basically organize what becomes the invasion of Normandy. And it's one of the only times in world history where truly millions of lives are at stake. And this is the moment where, you know, it's you see how precarious that alliance between the big three actually is.
It's an amazing story. And also, again, I think my favorite history teachers, when they would talk about history, it really was storytelling time. And they just knew how to, make history personal and really get into personal stories. And you're right. These incredible men with these very different goals had to work together. And yes, Churchill and Roosevelt obviously came to an understanding much earlier. And thankfully, Roosevelt was the right man at the right time. There was that isolationist movement in America, as we know, you and I being, you know, history fans, that could have kept us out of the war completely. God, great Americans like Charles Lindbergh didn't want us to get involved in World War II. You know.
Yeah, no, complete racist like Charles Lindbergh. I mean, right?
Yes,
I mean,
he did. Yes, I mean, that's the sad thing. We
right? I mean, that's the thing is you have like, you know, we look at him, we say, oh, again, we punched those Nazis. Like, we didn't want to punch any Nazis. No one in America wanted to go fight Nazis. what we wanted to do is completely be isolationist. We didn't, we had just, World War One had decimated the United States.
Yes.
Lost so many thousands of young men. The last thing anyone in America wanted was to lose more kids. And so, you know, and then of course the Great Depression happens. FDR is elected to save the country from ruin. And then the only reason we get involved at all, and again, everyone knows this part, is because Pearl Harbor. But even Pearl Harbor, we don't want to fight Nazis. We're just going to go fight Japan.
Yep.
We declare war against Japan. The only moron, the only reason we're fighting Nazis is because Adolf Hitler, in one of his many miscalculations during World War II, decides to declare war on us. You know, he miscalculates and thinks he can beat the Soviets. He's like, the Soviets will give up. They won't fight very hard. And of course, it's a huge miscalculation for him. And one of his other great miscalculations is he says, you know what? Weak people do not wait to have war declared on them. Strong nations declare war on others. And he's such a macho ass that he's like, we're going to declare war on the United States. And his own advisors are like, sir, don't do it. And it's Winston Churchill who remembers this quote that he once heard about the United States. And the quote is that the United States is like a gigantic boiler. And once you start a fire under it, there is no limit to the amount of power it will produce. And Churchill's absolutely right about that. But it's, you know, it's literally Hitler who slaps his knee in delight when Pearl Harbor happens and says, we're going to get in this fight too. And that's why we're suddenly fighting Nazis.
It's an incredible story. And yeah, I think you really humanize it. And I love the Lincoln conspiracy book you did as well. And
this one is,
I know,
like,
it's different.
And just to paint it a little different, let me just give you the moment of it is just because you talked about the story, and this is the story we started with, is FDR, they get him across to Tehran, Iran, which is where the big three meeting is going to take place. It's in Iran of all places, because Joseph Stalin's like, I want it here. This is where it's got to be. And he won't budge. You know, they measure out equidistant places. Well, no. How about Alaska? Alaska's close to you. No, nothing. He wants nothing. And we cave, and it's in Tehran, because he has an embassy there, and the British have an embassy there. There's better security there. In the desert, they think we'll be able to better keep the secret until the last minute that they're even meeting. And so here comes FDR. He's in the motorcade. Everyone is, you know, motorcade's coming down the center of the city, and everyone's craning their neck because they want to see the president of the United States in Tehran. And everyone's waving, and the president's waving back. But here's what nobody knows, is that the person in the motorcade is not FDR. It's actually a Secret Service decoy. The real FDR is across town, ducked down in the back of a beat-up sedan. And he's ducked down because he's worried, and they're worried that there's going to be a Nazi assassin who's going to murder him. And there's chapter one of the Nazi conspiracy for you. But that's where we started. And we were like, Josh mentioned, I'm my co-author there, just felt like we had to tell this story.
Brilliant. Absolutely. And yeah, man, it is these weird little things that are done to protect these guys, get them together and make important decisions. And also the whitewashing that FDR had to do to legitimize Stalin being part of the group, Uncle Joe, and all that crazy stuff of just like, oh no, he's our friend and everything. And again, it was means to an end as far as Stalin was concerned. And of course the great man Churchill. It's so great, because really the people that take the time, they're just images on newsreels or still photographs and stuff. And I really think you get on the human side of these people. And again, the great lengths to put them together and figure out a way of defeating Hitler and the Nazis.
Yeah, but you know, and the thing that I love in the story is that we all, you know, again, as you said, we know FDR, we know Stalin, we know Churchill. What I love are the people you've never heard of.
Yes,
right. There's a Nazi in there named Otto Skorzeny, and Otto Skorzeny is a special forces guy. He's a guy who gets the call one day that he needs to report to Adolf Hitler's secret headquarters, which they used to call the Wolf's Lair. And you know, when you're in for a rough day, when you're going to a place called the Wolf's Lair, it's not the party house, right? I mean, it's a serious spot you're going to. And Adolf Hitler, again, this whole story is true. None of it's made up. The Nazi conspiracy is complete fact. It's not, there's not nothing fictional about it. And what he finds out is that Adolf Hitler is bringing together all of his top special ops guys because he wants to find who the best one is. And he lines them up in this big room, shoulder to shoulder. And then he quizzes them with one question. He says, what do you think of Italy. And of course, all of them start kissing the butt of the boss, saying, oh, Italy's on our side, and we're going to fight to the death with them, and we're going to stand strong with them there. And one guy, Otto Skorzeny, this one Nazi, shouts above every other voice and says, I am from Austria, my Führer. And he's gambling there because he knows Adolf Hitler, of course, is from Austria.
Yes.
But he also knows that a true Austrian forever resents Italy because back in World War I, Italy took a key piece of Austria and never returned it. And in that moment, Adolf Hitler turns to Otto Skorzeny and he's like, you're my guy. You're my guy. And he sends Otto Skorzeny on a secret mission. I won't ruin it because you got to read that part of the book and it's so bananas. But it's such a crazy moment that Josh mentioned, on my co-author, said to the editor of the book, we need to put a photograph of this mission in the book, because if we don't, people will not believe that this really happened. They'll think we made it up. And so we literally paid extra money to put a photo in the book. And, you know, when you get to that page, you're just going to be like, I cannot believe this really happened and I don't know this story. And it's just, you know, you'll see why Otto Skorzeny's nickname suddenly becomes the most dangerous man in Europe. It's the wildest Nazi story you've never heard in your life.
Now, that leads me to a behind the scenes question, and that is, because I know, for instance, in movies, using music, using photographs and stuff has become very expensive. I mean, like Getty Images, I know if people Google search certain pop culture or historic photos, you might see Getty as one of the licensors of photographs and stuff. Is it expensive, Brad, to include photographs? I mean, how much does fair use
You'll see. You very quickly learn. I mean, yes, Corbis and Getty and the big ones are expensive. So we had, I mean, the Otto Skorzeny, it's funny, Otto Skorzeny has a couple portraits that were done of him. We wanted to also show him in the book. And like, one of them is like a head-on shot and one of them is like a three-quarter shot. And both of them, he just looks like the central casting of like bad guy Nazi.
Sure.
And, you know, with that one, we were like, just whatever, we'll go with the cheap photo because it doesn't matter. He looks like a jerk in any of them. He's horrible. Like, it doesn't matter. But on the day of the mission, the secret mission that I'm telling you about,
yeah,
it was actually, I believe the most we paid for any photo, because there was one shot where he's at the center and the other part of the secret mission is at the center. We're like, that's the best shot. And there's no question, we're not going to cheap out there. We're going to give you the best shot. I mean, and we even had to work with Marvel because it was very important to me when we were doing this book. We were talking about how, you know, how Americans were reacting to the start of World War II. Yes. And it was really, you know, no one wanted to go fight Hitler, but you know who wanted to fight Hitler? Jack Kirby did, and Stan Lee did, and you know, you Joe can Simon. Watch, and Joe Simon did.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, Siegel and Schuster did, and you see Joe Simon on the cover of Captain America #1, you know, punching Hitler in the jaw. And I was like, we need to put Captain America #1 in that book. And we all know the Kirby stories of him hating Nazis. Like those in, you know, the biography about him, they're really fun to read. But man, Joe Simon's stuff was so good. And that was one of the first places you saw people fighting back. And it was the first place, you know, you'd see Superman fighting Nazis.
Yes.
And I was like, we got to put that in the book. So we wound up talking, I forget it was to Marvel or who we had to talk to, but we literally paid or got the rights to put Captain America #1 in the Nazi conspiracy, like, because I just was determined that we had to put it in there.
That's great. You mentioned Siegel and Schuster too. And I forget what news magazine it was in, but it was how Superman would end the war. And this was still the war in Europe, because they even refer to Superman getting Hitler and was it Mussolini, that they were going to put him in front of the League of Nations under war crimes and everything.
Yeah, the other one that we didn't put in the book but is actually worth mentioning, because I did research on it once, but you know who else was one of the first ones? Were the Three Stooges.
Of course. Like, yes.
Right? There was like early stuff where they were like making fun, or maybe it was Charlie, was it Three Stooges or Charlie Chaplin? It was one of the old film guys. I'm going to have to look it up.
No, it was both.
It was both, right?
Yeah.
And they were just like, you know what? Everyone else... It was, you know what? No, it was Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator. Certainly. He was one of the first ones to make fun of Adolf Hitler. I think he might be the first one to make fun of Adolf Hitler on film. And before anybody did, nobody did. It came down to the comedians and the popular culture to take on Hitler before the government was willing to take on Hitler.
So true. And you can even find it, everybody, on YouTube. Chaplin puts a postscript on the movie where he really does a personal plea for everyone to kind of, you know, stop this man and stop this movement. And it's really amazing. And, you know, yeah, Chaplin was willing to put his balls up as far as that goes. I mean, The Lovable Tramp. And it's a Great Dictator is an amazing movie. And yeah, it was made before Pearl Harbor. It was 1943.
Right. So, I mean, anyway, the point being is, yeah, we wind up, to me, when we look for that, we have a moment in the book where we found, you know, because we're constantly going like, you know, when you see Kanye West shooting his mouth off, or when you see, you know, Nazis marching in Charlottesville, we all kind of wring our hands here in America. And we're like, oh, I can't believe this is happening here. You know, how is this happening here? And, you know, that should be something in Europe. That should be something in Germany back in the 40s. When we look back, you know, we found that actually at the beginning of World War II, there was a Nazi rally in Madison Square Garden, the heart of New York City, 20,000 people cheering in New York City for the Nazis. There's a giant banner of George Washington surrounded by swastikas. The first speaker of the rally says, if George Washington were alive today, he'd be friends with Adolf Hitler.
Isn't that crazy?
So why are we fighting Nazis in 2023? Because they never left. They never left. They're right here. And so, you know, and you see Kanye West shooting his mouth off. That's the same thing that Henry Ford did and Charles Lindbergh did, shooting off anti-Semitic comments happily and proudly back then. You'll constantly find celebrities who want to use their platforms for hate. And to me, it was important to tell those stories and show people that it's not, you know, just some black and white issue where like the Nazis are over there and we're over here and we're the good guys. Like, it is so much more complicated and so much more a part of our culture than we don't want to ever admit. And if you don't admit it, you're just going to keep reliving it.
Agreed. Absolutely, man. It's both books are amazing. The Nazi Conspiracy, already out. I Am John Lewis. I also know coming up on the I Am series, you got I Am Mr. Rogers.
We just announced that one. Yeah, we just put it on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. So, by the way, if you came to the book events, the book signings that I was doing, I told anyone who came to the book events, not only what Mr. Rogers, but who's coming after that. And I just said, I swore we had like a blood oath there. I said, I'm going to tell you who it is, who's coming next, but you can't tell anyone. So the next one is Temple Grandin comes out in March, our first autistic hero.
Yeah.
So she's coming in. She was amazing. She worked with us on her book and the I Am Temple Grandin book. And then after that, we do Wonder Woman. We're doing I Am Wonder Woman because we've done I Am Superman, I Am Batman. So we're doing Wonder Woman. And then, yeah, we're doing Mr. Rogers, which is just Chris Eliopoulos crushing it all day long.
Well, and it was great. Not only have you got the book coming out, but there was also an Xavier Riddle episode where the kids meet Fred.
Two-parter. We made it a two-parter episode, like when Happy Days used to meet Laverne and Shirley. We were like going all out. We were just like, this is not a single. But it was like our two-parters. I think last season we did Harriet Tubman, and Mister Rogers got the other two-parter because we were just like, and nothing else. I don't think there's one other book. I'm trying to think of. I don't want to say, but maybe one other. But Mister Rogers is one of the books that made me cry. It's one of the few books we've done where I literally read it and cried when we were done with it. Cause I was like, this is, you know, Chris, just there's a couple pages in there that are so emotional and so beautiful.
Well, I've seen the documentaries. I saw the Tom Hanks movie. I also loved the HBO Max Julia Child series where one episode where she is really down and at a PBS function, the guy that picks her up, Mr. Rogers.
And you know so many of those stories. I don't think we've done a half hour of television on him. We've done really our own little documentary on him. But even I was finding things that I just never knew about him, and they're just so beautiful. And you know, again, a book lets you kind of get in their head in a way that you never can when you're doing because you can get internal on them in a way you can't do in a documentary.
Sure.
And it was it's just really beautiful to watch him navigate his own life. You know, he was one of those kids who used to, and we'll talk about when we get there, but, you know, truly used to send away for the, you know, that thing that makes you from the weak guy into the muscle bound guy.
Oh, sure. Charles Atlas. Yes.
Right. Like he wanted, I don't know if it was Atlas or someone else, but he literally ordered one of those. And he was like, cause he was getting bullied so badly and, you know, just realized eventually that like the greatest strength you have, of course, is your kindness. It's not your muscles, right? It's the things you can't see that are the most powerful things in you.
Yeah, the definition of decency. Go on.
Yeah, yes. And no, and that's it. And you'll, I won't spoil it because we'll talk about it when it comes out, but it's just good. A beautiful, beautiful book.
I'm excited, man. No, I was thrilled to see the announcement. And I'm like, wait a minute, I think he covered this.
I'm serious. Like, no, go to my Instagram or my Twitter and go just scroll. It's like the last one on there, like the last tweet or so. And if you don't go, ah, then that means you're physically dead inside. That's it. You are dead. That is going to be proof. That is proof of death.
Understood. Well, Brad, being the superhero fan and a guy who's worked a lot at DC, what do you think of James Gunn's slate of what's coming up?
Oh, I'm excited. I'm 100% excited. Like, I couldn't be more. First of all, the thing about what James Gunn has done that's so beautiful is, you know what, the one thing, everyone has their own opinion and their own blah, 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 and everyone wants to, you know, the one thing that no one has said at all, nowhere that I can find, no one has said, man, that guy doesn't know his comics. Right? Like, everyone's like, the authority? Like, everyone has in their head, you know, we've all done that thing when they say, in those weeks before it was announced in his slate, like, we're all in our heads saying, well, I would do a Superman and I would do a Batman. And yeah, I'd like to do, we all had in our heads what we're going to do. And no one had on their bingo card Swamp Thing and the Authority. And this, like, it's just, you know, no one was like, I predicted it all. No one, the whole internet, which always will have someone saying, I knew it. Whatever you did, there's someone who's like, I knew it. No one saying I knew it. And that to me is proof positive you're doing something really right.
Agreed. And also, this is the guy that I remember talking to Bendis and Joe Quesada, and it's like, so what's coming up? Guardians of the Galaxy. And I'm like, why? And like, we know what we're doing, and we got the right guy, and it's going to be amazing. And that's why Creature Commandos and the Authority. It's like, of course, it's James Gunn. God, the putting Judo Master and Vigilante in the Peacekeeper TV series.
Right, right,
you know,
right.
It's like, this is the guy. This is the right guy.
No, right. I mean, again, like, the fact that he did Judo Master, right? Like, that alone just tells. And again, it goes back to, you know, Rocket and Groot. Like,
yeah.
I remember taking my kids. Every time I would take my kids to see a Marvel movie, now I've obviously been doing it for the past decade, like everyone else. Sure. My kids have kind of grown up. And they know to ask me, okay, Dad, tell us, give us the backstory before we go in on who everybody is. So, okay, here's Captain America. Here's Iron Man. Here's Thor. Here's Black Widow. Oh, here's Rhodey. Here's you. Pick whoever you want. I got them all. And I remember they did Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm like, I have them all. I got the guy who looks like a prism, even those issues. I got them all. But I don't even know what to tell you, man. I can't believe he's doing this. So I hope it's good. And obviously it was one of the best ones that they did, full of character, full of heart. And so to me, I'm ready. I'm following. I can't wait.
I'm so with you, man. And then also, God, ripped from today's headlines. I really wanted to know, because you're a guy, Brad, forgive me, because I know I ask you every time or almost every time you're on. You were part of that group of authors that were put together by the intelligence community to see if you could think of scenarios that where people might attack the United States. What was the name of that group you were with?
Yeah, the Red Cell Program. They called me and the Department of Homeland Security asked me to come in and brainstorm different ways terrorists could attack us. So I did it for a couple of years with them, which was, again, one of the most ridiculous moments of my life.
And amazing. But now here we are. They just shot down the Chinese balloon. I didn't hear the nickname until Sunday. Did you hear the great nickname that some newspapers gave the balloon?
I heard the one for the balloon shooter, for the guy who shot it down, but maybe I don't know which one you're talking about.
Well, of course, Red China with a balloon over the country. Red Zeppelin.
Red Zeppelin, fantastic. Whatever headline writer came up with that one earned their meal that day.
So, Jesus, I mean, this is the weirdest thing. As everyone points out on every news show, we've got spy satellites. You know there are human assets that are just walking through America collecting data. That's just the way intelligence works. And then there's this balloon, and also the one in Latin America, just a little drifting around and everything. It's like, wow, it's fascinating. I don't mean to trivialize it, but really the intelligence fiction nerd in me is like, oh my God, this is an amazing story. I wonder if you're like, oh wow, you know, that it might, you know, inspire some new fiction ideas for you.
I mean, I can't compete with reality because it's too bananas, right? Like, I can't make it up. I think it is interesting, right? Like, we have undercover people who, and I wrote this in, you know, in a book, there's an undercover organization that we have that infiltrates our colleges because they know that there are spies put into our own colleges to work their way through Silicon Valley, through the,
sure,
through the business system. I wrote about in The Escape Artist. It's like a key part of the plot, and you'll, yes, see in the book, it's like a, you know, it was, it's just really, and it's a really, really like dark way to look at the world, right? Is to like our youngest and our best and brightest are like being infiltrated. And you know that you have to, because that's where they're recruiting from. That's exactly where they're going to. And you, you know, but none of us bat an eye on that, but man, a balloon. And we're like, we lose our crap, man. We are. And also, I think it's just also, it's one of those few things that you can like visualize, and it feels so personal. It's like, you know, those undercover organizations that I'm not going to see them. I'm not going to know they're there. I'm never going to, they're never going to affect me. But, you know, a balloon right off the coast, it seems like, you know, it seems like something out of a kid's birthday party. So of course we lose our minds.
I wonder if this is how kids reacted back in the 50s when we learned about Sputnik.
And no, I think in the 50s, the difference was, is there was, yeah, it was a real fear, right?
That's
like
true.
They're literally like, oh, they're going to beat us and we're going to lose the Cold War. We're kind of like, we're just pissed at each other, like arguing over who shot it down first. You know, like we're just using this whole thing as another excuse to fight. And again, not to turn it back to the Nazi conspiracy, but the one thing I've realized, like I've crossed the country now for 2 weeks talking to, like, I'm going from Tulsa, Oklahoma, right? Like these very conservative parts of the country,
sure,
to New York City, right? These super liberal parts of the country.
Yep.
And the one thing that I see, you know, and I took this book on, you know, MSNBC and Fox News, like, right, like the two polar opposites of where we are. And the one thing that I've realized when I, you know, watching all of this is, and I'll just say it this way, Hitler used to, you know, it there's a recipe for authoritarianism. And what Adolf Hitler used to do, you know, he saw these native born white Germans who were suffering economically. And he was like, you know what? Those people, he points his finger, Adolf Hitler does, those people are the cause of your problems. And when someone says those words so definitively, when, you know, it's proven, like when you ask psychologists, when someone says something definitively to you, you actually very quickly automatically get defensive because you assume it to be true. So when he says those people, right, you're like, I'm like, oh my gosh, who are those people? Like, I'm mad at those people. They're the cause of my problems. I hate those people. And we see it, of course, he's talking about the Jewish people in World War II, but we've seen it, yeah, in those people being the black community, the immigrant community, the gay community, pick your minority community. And the one thing I hope people hear, and we're doing it right now again, is that's a sucker bet when you hear those words, those people. It's a code. It's a code to make you mad. And
yep,
the reason why politicians, I don't care what your politics are, the reason politicians want you mad is angry people vote. And the reason your cable television show wants you mad is because angry people watch TV. They're good for ratings. So don't be a sucker and just take place in the fight. Like, look at it as best you can. Find your information from a place that isn't designed to enrage you for their own benefit. Find politicians who aren't there to enrage you for your own benefit, for their own benefit. And to me, that's the lesson of World War II to me. Is like, you know, the American dream is not about money to me. It's about seeing someone who's being bullied and seeing someone who's being picked on and saying, you know what? You can't do that. Enough. Enough.
I'm with you, man. No, and critical thinking is more important than ever. And I, again, we kind of grew up in that Watergate era of don't trust the man. And the man is not just one monolithic thing. And you should. You should absolutely question everything you hear, certainly from politicians on both sides of the aisle, and don't settle, and also don't walk away. You've got to be engaged, and you've got to find your own truth, and that's not, and don't just, well, they're all screwed. Screw them. I'm going to walk away because they're playing with your life, both sides.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, you know, the hard part is, it used to be would be, you know, we were fighting the man, and the man did seem like it was one person. Now we're fighting everybody. Everybody's,
yep,
fighting everybody. You know, like, I mean, you see it on the internet. Like, someone says, I love the moon. And someone's like, oh, so you hate the sun? Like, no, no. Like,
around.
I'm stealing that joke from someone that said it. And it's such a good joke. And it's, but it's like, you know, just take a breath, take a breath. And before you pick the fight, like, take it all in, right? We're so worked up over a balloon just because we want to be worked up. That's it. And listen, of course we don't want anyone spying us. No one wants anyone spying us. We shouldn't have people spying us. It's a total fiasco. But I love that we took this thing that was supposed to be in another country against us, and we use it just as a way to fight ourselves.
And turn it on each other. Absolutely.
That's it.
No, well, I know you got to go. Everybody, The Nazi Conspiracy, out now, an incredible nonfiction account and incredible little crevices of stories that you wouldn't expect. It's a lot more than just the headlines we've all grown up with. And, of course, the latest I Am book, I Am John Lewis. Looking forward to Temple Grandin and Wonder Woman, and eventually as well, Fred Rogers. As always, Brad, great chat, and I really appreciate it. Please come back when Wonder Woman and Temple are ready to roll.
I appreciate it. And thanks for looking out for our entire community, John. I say it every time, and I always say hi to Noah, who always listens, my brother. But the calculator is always on. But our community is a tight community, but it also needs a lot of love and support. And I appreciate you always supporting all the people in this community who work so hard putting out their creative ideas out there into the universe. And, you know, it's so hard right now to kind of get people to pay attention. And what I love about your show is you give so many people out there a chance to kind of show what they've done. It's really appreciated.
Thanks, man. Well, you know, later tonight, Eric Pilecki is going to be on talking about his latest graphic novels.
That's great.
And later this week, Dan Juergens is going to join me and Mark Russell.
So I love Dan. I know Dan. He's great. I'm so happy for him to see everything with Booster. That's good stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, man. He's one of the guys that is certainly benefiting from the James Gunn attention. So that's great. Thanks for listening and watching, everybody. Until next time, stay safe, stay happy, stay healthy.